This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 9th of January 2010, and today I'm talking with Nathan Allenby, a writer and researcher who has been examining the worldwide implementation of national ID card schemes and database systems. His writing can be found on globalresearch.ca, and his latest article, ID Cards, Intergovernmental Cooperation in Worldwide Implementation, can be found at the Corbett Report homepage. Nathan, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Mr. Allenby, let's start today by finding out about yourself and how and why you became interested in researching these ID card schemes.
That's a really long story. I've been an activist in one way or another for about 20 years, mainly working on local communities and the abuse of their rights. And I've been pushed into this one way or another. The development of ID card schemes, I think, is a very important issue for all aspects of civil rights. Some people have said that we're already living in a police state. It's just that the state has actually imposed oppression on us. So in many ways, we're totalitarian. That is to say, the state has become interested in every aspect of our lives, the totality of our lives. And that it's authoritarian in that ordinary people don't actually influence its decisions, and that the amount of democratic input is actually really quite nominal. But it isn't actually at this point oppressive. You know, people aren't being carted off to jail. But at the same time, the machinery is all there. So perhaps that's the more extreme end of the scenario. I'm sure a lot of people don't feel like that, but if for some reason the state was to decide that there was a state of emergency or that civil rights couldn't be continued, we could see the situation change very rapidly, and all of the equipment is in place.
Well, I think that's a very keen observation, because there are many people who are happy to go along with this until it's pointed out to them the potential dangers of this. And I think people need to be reminded every so often of why a technological control grid is not a good idea and how it could become abused if it's not being abused already. So let's start by bringing people up to speed then with the articles that you wrote on this subject last year. So could you give us a quick overview of what types of databases and ID card systems we're talking about and where they're being implemented?
Well, this is really how I started to get interested in this subject, and I scared the pants off me. About 10 years ago, I was in India, and there was a proposal that they were going to introduce ID cards in one of the largest Indian states, Uttar Pradesh. Now, if you've ever been to India, I would describe India as a state of chaos. And, you know, the idea that everyone's going to carry an ID card and they're going to be monitored, their movement, well, it's so against Indian culture that you couldn't actually believe it. And yet, last year, 2009, they announced that ID cards were coming in nationwide in India. So this is something like 1.2 billion people. They're going to have a universal ID card system. And it's actually being explicitly designed to track the movements of every Indian person. Now, for somebody like me who's actually lived in India, it's staggering. The shock of hearing this was unbelievable. And in fact, what's being proposed in India is the latest and most advanced ID card system, and it's actually representative of what's coming everywhere else. So all of the databases, all of the personal information databases in India are being merged together, and they're being made accessible through a single ID card. So you've got information from the tax system, those people who pay tax, and then you've got the electoral roll, and you've got food aid schemes, and there are all sorts of things which people might register for in India, and lots of little local databases, India is divided into independent states, federal states, much like USA. So there might be local registration in that. All of that is being combined into one system, and it's accessible through one card. And this card will actually track people as they move about India from place to place. So the electoral roll will be updated according to where that card has been located. They're actually going to know from where your card pops up where you live, and they're going to update your position on the electoral register. So this is a tracking device. It's going to know where people are. Now, this is not just what's happening in India. This is what's going to happen everywhere. It turns out that, you know, this is very, very similar to what's happening everywhere else. And you'd think, well, 1.2 million, 1.2 billion people, how on earth can they implement a scheme for such a huge number of people in such a culture that is completely opposed to this? But in fact, it can happen really rapidly. And indeed, it's going to be finished by the end of 2010, this year. So in a space of 18 months, they've already gone through the pilot schemes that happened at the beginning of 2009. This is up and working. Now it's available technology. It's going to be finished. End of 2010, 1.2 billion people are going to have their ID cards, and they're going to be locked into this system. And that's how fast it can happen. And this is what's happening elsewhere. In Britain, we've got a project called Transformational Government. And this is a project that's going to completely change the nature of the way government services are delivered in Britain. And it's about data sharing, and it's about departments being able to have access to the information in other government departments. So instead of having firewalls between the different departments and the information that you give for one purpose being kept for that purpose and not shared with another department, so the tax can't look at your data on, say, social services. Now they're going to be able to look at everything. And all of that is going to just meld together. And, this is actually going to make a large amount of difference to how departments are organized, and the fact that they can be organized through the database rather than in the sort of structures focused more on delivery that they had in the past. And then there's another aspect. So this is, first of all, we've looked at the large scale. Second, we've looked at the fact that this is happening in other countries. You know, it's not just isolated in one country. And then there's the fact that there's actually a project to exchange this data between nations. So, for example, if you were to look at the European Union, and Britain's very much part of the European Union project, there are schemes to exchange data inside Europe. And something that came through the Hague program 5 years ago was a process to ensure interoperability of data and the accessibility of data. And a number of agreements have been implemented. Obviously, there's a general principle, and then it gets implemented through a series of agreements and detailed regulations. But it's been carefully coordinated that all databases in Europe will be able to exchange data, and that they're organized on a common format, and that the data systems are capable of working together so that one nation can ask for information about a citizen of another nation. Now, this is supposed to facilitate the free movement of travelers inside Europe. It's supposed to be an area of free movement, the Schengen area, established by the Schengen Agreement, where a single market, a single nation, and citizens can move about. But it also means that, say, for example, someone in Romania can look up information on someone in Britain. Well, of course, that's really useful if somebody in Britain is going to live somewhere like Romania. But, of course, you've got to remember also that it's quite controversial as well, because judicial decisions in Romania have been extremely controversial. Their judicial process doesn't seem to meet the standards that, say, British people or French or German people would be comfortable with. So having the Romanian state having access to our data and being able to find things out about us might not be something that we're comfortable about. Now, of course, if this was just inside Europe and the European Union, well, that would be, you know, that would be uncomfortable enough, but, you know, that would be, you know, something that we could handle. But in fact, it seems that this process actually goes much further, and it's actually worldwide. And when I started to realize this, it absolutely shocked me. It sent me white. There's a process that's been going on to control immigration worldwide. And this is both to control legal migration and to control illegal immigration. Now, this is something that's been developing over about a decade. And it's based upon the sort of processes that the US government has been developing to control its border with Mexico, for example. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they want, the governments of the world want to be able to exchange data with each other so that they can identify people who are migrants, both legal migrants who are coming from the developing countries to work in Europe or America. For example, a lot of doctors in Britain are actually migrants from countries like India and African states such as Gambia, and that there should be seamless data exchange so that it's possible to track the data, the histories about these people, whether or not they have criminal records or whether or not there's any previous history about them, so that when they're in one country, say for example when they come to Europe, we can know what their history is in Africa, whether or not they've got the educational qualifications they say. And also, when they go back to their home countries, that their home countries can find out what happened to them and what they did when they were in the developed world, in Europe or in America. It's also a system that information can be accessed between developing countries, so that you know, when somebody pops up in a neighbouring country, they know where they've come from, who they are, and the history about them. And of course, there is a very, very large amount of population movement these days. Population is moving more than it ever has done in the history of the world. And it's for a number of reasons. People are being driven off their land and they're having to move. And sometimes they're moving inside their own country. They're moving from, you know, the fields, from the land, into the metropolis, into, say, the large cities. And then generally, we're not talking about into the larger cities scattered about the country. We're talking about movement into, you know, a single capital city. So you're getting these very, very large slum developments developing with tens of millions of people who've come from goodness knows where, and it's hard for the state to keep track of them. And this system helps them. And sometimes these people aren't staying inside their own country. They can't make it, and they're going actually into the next country. And again, tens of millions of people are migrating across borders. When these people turn up, they need to find out where they're from, and you know, potentially how to send them back, where to send them to. And so this exchange of information makes it possible for governments to track these people and know what to do with them. And this has all been set up through a series of meetings and conferences that have taken place over a decade. I'm sorry, this is a lot to absorb.
It is a lot to absorb, but I think it's important because there are so few people out there who are bringing attention to this issue. So it's an issue that a lot of people really don't know anything about, which is why I think we do need quite a bit of overview to get into the subject. And once again, I'd like to recommend people go and read ID Cards, A Worldview, and ID Cards, An Historical View, which were both published on the globalresearch.ca website last year as an excellent way of coming up to speed with these issues. But you've already started to touch on some of the issues raised in your latest article, ID Cards, Intergovernmental Cooperation in Worldwide Implementation. So let's get into some of the specific aspects of that article and the dots that you're connecting in that research. So, for example, what is ICAO 9303 Part 3 and why is it important?
Well, indeed, this is a very important document because it's actually about the interoperability of ID systems worldwide, that the ID cards are substantially the same and that they can all be used in different countries, that one country is going to be able to recognize and operate the ID card from another country. So if somebody from Sierra Leone turns up in Britain, that they can put that country's ID card in a British ID card reader, and it's going to work, and all the information is going to pop up. And that's actually quite an important aspect, that these systems are interoperable and that they permit data exchange to happen. And the fact that there is an international standard that's been set by the International Civil Aviation Authority, a UN-affiliated body, it actually tells us how this process has happened and how it's been implemented. Now, it hasn't happened by accident, it hasn't grown up, just by coincidence that one country's adopted another country's system, but it has actually been coordinated at an international level through international agreements. And if you look at the ID cards themselves, they are very highly standardized. You know, they're standardized by a variety of different standards. You know, there's the ICAO standard, and then of course there are ISO, International Standards Organization standards for all of the materials. But these cards are substantially identical around the world. And that really gives, you know, an insight into what we're looking at here. And of course, one thing leads on to another, that if you once you realize that the data on the card is standardized, you realize that the data fields are standardized as well. So, you know, the data fields are of a common format. So if you wanted to look at somebody's biometric information, well, there's going to be substantially a common format, that this card also contains all of the personal information that the various different categories, and that the ID cards of other countries are going to contain the same information in the same formats. And when you realize that all countries in the world are going to have computer systems that are designed to read the same cards, you realize that in fact their data systems have all been standardized as well. And this is something that actually happened in parallel with the implementation of the ID cards, that all of the countries around the world have adopted the same format of database systems. Of course, it's all designed for the international exchange of data. So not only can, you know, say the social services department in your country look up your tax records or other information about you, but that other departments in other countries can find that information about you as well. So it's just one aspect of the way this process has actually taken place.
That's right. And I think that is one of the most horrifying aspects of this, not just the implementation of technological tyranny at a national level, but truly being organized and coordinated at an international level. And I think the horrors of that should become apparent to anyone who thinks through the ways in which this type of system could be abused and even simply used, because I don't think there's any way to use this in a way that would protect privacy rights or the rights of individuals. So it is a horrifying situation. So what would you say to someone who is ready to take the government side on this and insist that this is a potentially wonderful technology for stopping illegal immigration and helping law enforcement to fulfill their duties?
Well, I would say the scheme is primarily designed to facilitate migration. Now, I know a lot of people, they talk about illegal immigration, but let's not call it legal or illegal, let's just call it migration, and that it is actually planned to increase migration worldwide, and it's certainly planned to increase migration into Britain, and it's a way of fueling our economy. That it's said that we need people with these skills. There's a whole development agenda that's associated with this, and the issues are very complex. One of the things that I would say for everybody, both people who are opposed to the government agenda and for the people who support the government agenda, is that they need to look at things in a connected way. So, if they're going to look at migration, then they've got to look at international development. They've actually got to look at our policy on trade with nations. They've got to look at their security agenda. They've got to look at policing. All of these things are linked together. The policies haven't developed separately. They're all integrated, and if you look at the policy on migration and what's happening in terms of international development, you will find that development policies in the third world are actually displacing people from land and from stable lifestyles. This is what's fundamentally what driving migration worldwide. Now, one country that's very dear to my heart, a country that I love, is India. And having lived in India, I'm quite well aware that over the next decade, and it'll probably be a lot faster than a decade, 40% of their population is going to be displaced from the land into cities. So they're going to move from a situation at the minute where only about 40% of the Indian population live in cities. Only 40% are urbanized, and 60% live on the land, to a situation where 80% of the population are going to live in cities, and only 20% are going to live on the land. And this is a policy that's being forced through by the World Bank. The Indian government has adopted it, but they're pretty much over a barrel. They don't have much room to manoeuvre on this. It's pretty much been dictated to them. And if you were to look at other countries, you would find they're in a similar situation. The Indian government is, in some ways, selling their own people's land to other countries. They're selling access to resources. They're selling, special economic zones. There are all sorts of things that are happening. And also the Indian government has agreed that it's going to adopt a development strategy based on urbanization.
That is an absolutely key part of this, because I think people need to understand that the issue here is not simply one of ID cards and databases. The issue is a chipping away of national sovereignties in the name of a globalization process, which of course is, as we know, is designed to really benefit the developed nations at the expense of the developing nations and the use of their land. And of course, there aside from the national sovereignty issues and the migration issues, there's also privacy issues, which are, again, I would use the term horrifying, but maybe that's my own particular take on it. But tell us about some of the schemes like Digital Tsunami, which are being implemented right now.
Well, again, now I haven't done this original research. This is being done by one of the most authoritative research organizations in the world, State Watch. Now, I don't know how many listeners will be familiar with State Watch, but they are an incredible outfit that pours through the tons of data that comes out of the European Union. And the European Union produces this incredible volume of paperwork, of directives, of regulations, of agreements that are hammered out in secret. Ironically, these agreements are made in secret, and then they become very largely publicly available, but it's all hidden in the total volume. You know, how can you go through this stuff? And when you do read it, the language that it uses is mind-numbing. It's so dull. It's very hard to appreciate the significance of this. Because this very dry, dull-sounding document can actually have very far-reaching impacts. Like, for example, if we were to talk about interoperability of systems, you know, unless you already had some kind of a key as to what this means, you know, it wouldn't mean very much at all. Anyway, State Watch have gone through the future programs of the European Union. And they've come across the documents which reveal this process for information gathering about every citizen, every individual. And it's a digital tsunami, or sometimes it's called a data tsunami in other documents. There's going to be this tidal wave of information that's going to be newly obtained about everyone. So it's going to be... every time you buy something, every time you go somewhere, your movements are going to be recorded. And it's mind-numbing, the implications of this. There's nothing that you're going to be able to do that isn't going to be recorded and put on a database that's available to everyone. So we're now, this is also happening in the United States. Let's not pretend that this is just Europe. You know, the technology and the ideas have very much been imported from USA. So we're talking about things like RFID, you know, the radio frequency ID, RFID. This is where we put little tags are put in every consumer item, everything that you buy from a store is going to have a radio barcode. But unlike a barcode that just says, no, I am a can of baked beans, I am a can of milk, this is going to say, I am a particular item, you know, distinguished from its identical neighbor. And this technology was designed for stores so that they could... track the movements of goods in their warehouses. You know, they would know when, say, a carton of milk was made, when it was sent to the warehouse, which pallet it was on, which shelf, when it was taken, and you know, which cartons went to which store. But then they found, hey, you know, we can leave these things on and we can track them and we can find out who buys our goods and we can actually profile our customers and find out all this information about them. So commercial technology is actually being designed to be able to track customers, to be able to find their histories, to be able to have targeted marketing. Unfortunately, governments have realized that the same technology enables them to find out all about their citizens. Okay, so let's talk about RFID and what it does, because this is just one example of the numerous technologies that are being implemented. And one of the key technologies is something called the Internet of Things. And the European Union has an official state policy that this is going to be developed. There's a massive investment and it's going to be implemented. It's a device to make RFID information available to everyone. It's called the Internet of Things because instead of the current internet where people talk to each other, this is going to be an internet where machines talk to each other, where things talk to each other. And it's primarily designed to make information gathered by machines about RFID, radio frequency ID, available. So say, for example, we're in a future situation. All your clothes have been bought and they've got RFID chips in them. Now, RFID is being designed, better start at the beginning. It's designed so that when you buy items, they're going to be able to know what you've got on you. And if you go up to a checkout, say for example, they're going to be able to recognize that you've got so many items on you and what they are and how much they cost, and you're going to be able to present your card and they'll bill you instantly. Now, people are familiar with things like anti-theft portals in stores, and these barriers at the door, the induction loop, where if you walk out and you haven't paid for something, it rings an alarm. Well, these are actually starting to be replaced in some stores with RFID readers, so that when you go out of the store, if you're carrying an item that's got an RFID tag, because it's got a database of all RFID items, it's going to know whether or not that particular item has been purchased or it hasn't been purchased. So say, for example, they're going to have, Coca-Cola is one of the companies that's been investing very heavily in this technology and its development. So let's take the example of a Coke bottle. If you go out with a Coke bottle, there'll be a database that'll know whether or not that Coke bottle has been sold or whether or not it's unsold. And if it clicks up that that Coke bottle is unsold, that it hasn't been recorded as being sold yet, then the alarm will go off. Now, if you imagine that all of your clothes have been bought on the same basis, say for example, it can look at your shoes or your underpants. When you go out through that portal, it's going to register all of the clothes that you've got on. So say for example, your shoes, they're going to have a complete history of your shoes. Now they're going to know every time your shoes were sighted by the system. You know, oh, it was picked up by the RFID reader at that store. Oh, and then it was picked up at this transport terminal. And then it was picked up at that government building. And so all the RFID readers are going to be interfaced together into one system. And the information that they pick up is going to be put into a common information system. And that common information system is going to effectively, it's going to collect information about items, but it's going to be information about people. And so, for example, people don't share shoes. You know, your wife will not borrow your shoes. Your son, you know, probably won't borrow your shoes either. You know, they're particular to one person. So if you have the history of everywhere the shoes have been, well, you've got the history of that person and where they've gone to. And, you know, you'll be able to work out, well, if you know what the shoes the person was wearing, you're probably going to be able to cross-reference the other items that person was wearing. And they're actually, it's a relatively trivial matter to cross-reference all of a person's possessions. In fact, there are systems available to do that. And IBM took out a patent several years ago on something called a person tracking system that was designed to cross-reference that data to work out movements of people and where they'd gone. So This is one aspect of the digital tsunami. Now, RFID is going to be in your possessions, it's going to be in your clothing, it's going to be in the things that you buy. It's also going to be in your ID card. It's also going to be in other things that you have, the various things that you have access to get other services, such as library cards. Most academic library cards have got RFID in them. So you're going to find, you know, that all of the things that you use in your life have got RFID in them. Now, one of the things that's coming into Britain is a national public transport system, an integrated public transport ticketing system. And this is going to have what they call smart tickets, tickets with RFID in them. So there's going to be one ticketing system for your local bus or for the train that will take you to the other end of the country. And you're going to be able to buy a ticket on the bus that will, you know, with your mobile phone or whatever, that will you know, take you from point to point, from your house to, a building in a distant town. That you're going to have the ability to get on, a bus and then a train and then a coach and then another bus or whatever. And it's all going to be seamless and integrated. But it's also going to be a system for information exchange through these various different transport companies, and it's going to collect the information about those journeys. So we've got these incredible information systems that are developing. Now, these systems don't just exchange information between companies, and they don't even just gather information for companies. The information that's gathered by corporations about, you know, private sector use of sold items is also going to be available to governments. So the information that's on the Internet of Things about which clothes we prefer to wear, which shops we prefer to buy our goods at, that's also going to be transparent and available to the government. So they're going to get all sorts of information about your movements that they never had before. They're going to know which shop you were at on Saturday morning, and they're probably going to be able to, because they're going to be able to tell which people went through the store barrier at the same time. So they're going to know who you were with. They're going to know. They're going to be able to get information about which people you associate with. So, for example, stores are going to be interested to know whether or not you go shopping with your wife, you know, or whether or not you go shopping on your own. And that's the sort of information that they might use in targeted marketing. But if somebody else was to look at the same data, it's quite easy to pick up information about whether or not you're going shopping or you're regularly seen with a different individual. And the researchers who have been looking at this have come up with a very terrifying scenario. They're going to be able to tell, for example, anyone is going to be able to tell, if with the right profiling equipment, the right software, they're going to be able to look at this data on the Internet of Things, and they're going to be able to tell your personal habits. So say, for example, you're cheating on your wife and you've got a mistress. Well, they're going to be able to see that information from the Internet of Things. And they're going to be able to blackmail you. So the profiling software is going to be for sale. It's going to be commercially available. And it can be bought by, frankly, anybody. So what would happen if somebody who didn't have benign motives was going to be able to pick up this information? Well, they'd be able to tell, if you had secrets to hide. Now, we could have a situation where private individuals get blackmailed. For example, organized crime could pick up their data, could find their embarrassing secrets, and could, extract a payment, for blackmail. Or we could get a situation where, for example, a government servant could be blackmailed, that they might have embarrassing details in their personal life, and they could be blackmailed by a foreign nation. There's no limit to what this could mean. People are not used to this sort of scenario. It's very frightening. It's very new. There hasn't been a chance for ordinary people to digest and absorb what this technology means. I think it's more far-reaching than even the people who've taken time to think about it really understand.
That's certainly the case, I think, and you break it down very well there, but as you said before, it is mind-boggling to be thinking about this. So given that we are on the brink of an Orwellian nightmare society, and there are very few people who want to live in such a world, what do you see as our means of resisting this technological tyranny?
Well, that's a very good question. The first thing is people have got to stop volunteering their personal information. So people have to stop using the devices that are interfaced with these data systems. Classic example is don't pay for things with a card. Use cash if you can. Find out whether or not the items that you're buying have got RFID. Consumer pressure is enormously powerful. I would direct people to look at the campaign organization Caspian, which is led by a terrific campaigner, a lady called Catherine Albrecht. Now, Caspian had incredible success in stopping the adoption, or slowing the adoption, of RFID systems by stores. When people realized that RFID was in their goods, and when there was a campaign against it, stores suddenly found that they were losing sales. People didn't like this idea, and that they were, you know, and people would stop shopping. So this is what people have to do. They have to get involved with these campaigns. They have to find out, you know, they have to join Caspian. They have to listen and find out which stores are using RFID. And they have to boycott those stores. Now, consumer pressure turns out to be the biggest weapon that we have. And it has been incredibly effective. You know, we're ending up in a situation where, you know, we're not very powerful as voters, but politicians don't listen to us as voters. But stores and corporations listen to us as consumers. We actually have more power as consumers than as voters. And that's the sort of democracy that we have in this consumer society. So start with consumer pressure. Don't cooperate with them. People have got to become more aware, and they've got to become more active. They've got to try and join the organizations that provide them with information and tell them how to fight back. I know some people go out and they join political campaign groups. I have mixed feelings about how effective some of those groups are. People should weigh the value of these organizations by the empowerment that they give them, whether or not they give them information on things that they can do and how to fight back. So join a campaign that actually tells you what you can do to fight this system and to assert yourself in the marketplace. As I say, Caspian is the best. Caspian is the best, but there are other campaigns out there, and you've got to be active. It's no good being passive here. If you're going to be passive, then you're going to wake up in a police state.
I agree wholeheartedly with that, and it is time for people to get involved, and to get involved in a meaningful way. And I think you're right that, unfortunately, maybe our wallets are the best way that we can vote at this point in time. But definitely I encourage people to do their own research and to find organizations that best reflect their feelings on this issue. Nathan Allenby, what's the best way for people to keep up with your work in particular?
Well, I wouldn't describe myself as a major researcher. I have very much drawn on the research that has been done by other organizations, and in particular by Statewatch. So if people really want to find out, the first thing I would suggest is to look at the State Watch site. And then the next thing is to actually subscribe to it if they want more information, and they'll get regular news information from them. Another organization to look at is the European Civil Liberties Network. So that's ECLN.org. Another thing that they can do is they can join the group Caspian, which is absolutely free. You can sign up online and you'll get regular news updates about boycotts to take part in and things that you can do as a consumer. And there are one or two other organisations that you can join. In Britain, there's an organisation called No CCTV, an anti-surveillance organisation, another group that I'd recommend very strongly. I think that's a really good start.
Okay, well, that's excellent. And as I say, I hope people will also check into your articles in particular and into all of those organizations. But Nathan Ellenby, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
And thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to come onto your site. You know, you are doing such a wonderful job in alerting people to current issues.
Well, thank you very much.